Welcome to the Jet Setter Show, where we explore lifestyle-friendly destinations worldwide. Enjoy and learn from a variety of experts on topics ranging from upscale travel at wholesale prices to retiring overseas, to global real estate and business opportunities, to tax havens and expatriate opportunities. You'll get great ideas on unique cultures, causes, and cruise vacations. Whether you're wealthy or just want to live a wealthy lifestyle, the Jet Setter Show is for you. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Jet Setter Show. This is Jason Hartman, your host, where we explore lifestyle-friendly destinations worldwide. I think you'll enjoy the interview we have for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds here on the Jet Setter Show.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about investing in and managing income properties for college students, there's a show for that. If you want to learn how to get noticed online and in social media, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to save on life's largest expense, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know about America's crime of the century, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
My pleasure to welcome Jay Butler to the show. He is an expert in asset protection and overseas citizenship opportunities. He's with Asset Protection Services International, and he's coming to us today from a beautiful small coastal town on the Italian Riviera. Lucky you, Jay. Welcome. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me, Jason.
My pleasure. So tell us a little bit about your background, if you would.
I would be happy to. First, I really wanted to congratulate you for bringing real news to the general public and inserting issues and not the dinosaur prestitute media talking points, which are basically just misinformation and disinformation outlets. So I really encourage your listeners to support programs like these and their sponsors.
Well, thank you so much, because the corporate media, it's just amazing to me, Jay. You look at the news almost all over the planet now, and it's like the same six stories. You'd think there's nothing else going on in the world but what they want you to hear. It's really ridiculous. So thank you very much. I agree with you about that. And I love that term, prestitutes, by the way.
Correct.
That's a good one. Well, yeah. So now you're a U.S. citizen, right?
Correct. I was born in America. I grew up for the most part in Denver, Colorado. Received my bachelor's degree of fine arts from Boston University. Spent several years out in Los Angeles working with the former city attorney, Carl Lovell Jr. Co-authored a book with him on asset protection called Cover Your Assets. And I'm currently studying for my Master in Laws through the University of London with a specialization in international business law. So although I'm not an attorney, I'm working toward it. And I've had the opportunity to travel to 32 countries around the world and have resided in five.
Wow. So you've resided in five different countries and been all around. That's great. Now, what prompted you to get into this business? And I guess your business is helping people learn about other opportunities, expatriation opportunities, and international or global asset protection strategies, right?
Correct. Primarily, we focus for United States citizens, for citizens in the U.S. who reside within the United States. We really encourage people to do everything possible to stay onshore. And the reason I say that is as soon as you step across that border, the expression I like to use is you'd better be good at making coffee, because you're going to get a knock on your door from the IRS asking you to explain the reason for your actions to go offshore. So if you have legitimate business reasons to be conducting business internationally or taking some of your assets offshore, you really just need to make sure that you're doing it properly and not for reasons which could really create a lot of attention for yourself unnecessarily. Also, for those people, which I believe is the focus of our show today, is if you want to leave the United States and you see the writing on the wall and you'd like to be able to live and work in another country, what are your options? Where do you go and how do you go about doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very confusing. I mean, you know, I've read a lot about this. I've heard a lot about it. For example, if you want to become an expat and say you're an American, now we have a global audience, so you know, just let's keep that in mind. It's not just Americans listening. But if you want to become an expat, where is the best place to go? Or do you really go anywhere physically? Maybe you stay where you are and just change your citizenship or get dual citizenship so you have two passports. What are the advantages? Why would anyone want to do that? There's just so many layers to this. There's a lot of layers of the onion to peel back.
Sure. It depends, of course, since we do have a global audience, it depends on the laws of the jurisdiction in which you currently reside or where you were born. Generally speaking, most countries do allow for dual citizenship. If you obtain a passport or citizenship in another nation, it's generally not required that you give up your country of birth or your existing citizenship. You can choose to do so, but it's generally not a requirement. If you're of retirement age and you can provide documentation to verify a particular amount of monthly income, whether it's a Social Security benefit or other type of financial instrument like a stock, a bond, mutual fund, CD, etc., you really have the world at your oyster. You can pretty much pick almost any country you'd like to go to, either in Central or South America, with being able to provide that source of income for your retirement. The challenge is for a little bit of a younger generation. I'm coming up on 40 myself, where if you'd like to move offshore, you need to be able to work and, you know, create an income and a livelihood for yourself and your family. And that's where it becomes a little bit more difficult for the requirements to obtain a work visa.
What you're saying then is a lot of these countries will allow you to come and be there, but they won't give you a work visa, so you can't actually have a job and earn an income then.
Well, you can, but you've got to jump through some hoops to do it. Normally, you'd have to have a company sponsor you, or you could go in that country and form your own, you know, corporation or company or equivalent of an LLC, for example, and then you'd have to fund that operation. A lot of times they might have minimum requirements for how many local employees you would have to hire and things of that nature. But if you actually wanted to hire yourself, oftentimes you'd have to run an ad in the local paper putting out the opportunity for someone locally to fulfill that job position. And only after it's been substantiated that the local community could not provide that work would you then be allowed to fulfill your own position. So it can be very expensive to do that, and there can also be a fair amount of risk if your business isn't successful, if you don't know the market or the economy or the tax laws or the general asset protection laws of that jurisdiction. It can be very trying on a person.
Well, first of all, maybe let's just back up a little bit. Why would someone want to do this? Say, let's take, since most of the audience is probably U.S., let's take an American, for example.
Well, I happen to have a belief that documentation beats conversation. And I'd like to point out just some of the laws that have passed in the United States just in the last 10 years. And the reason I do this is because it points a direction that the country is headed in that many people are able to sense now but might not be able to necessarily verify with a particular document. So let's take a look at some of these. You've had the passage of the Plunge Protection Act, PDD 51, which is where the government can get involved in the financial markets. Patriot Acts 1 and 2, Victory Acts 1 and 2, the Enemy Combatants Act, Military Tribunals Act, the Military Commissions Act 2006, the John Warner Defense Authorization Act 2007, the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008 was the big banker bailout bill, right? FISA, your Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the ability to spy on American citizens, the Security and Prosperity Partnership Initiative of North America, the fusion of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico coming into place, the Federal Continuity Directive, FDC-1, that has to do with the continuity of directives in general at the COD. Then you have the end of the Glass-Steagall Act. That was the separation of the commercial and investment banking, which has created a lot of bubbles, in particular the housing bubble. We've had over $30 trillion in banker bailout funds going to foreign offshore banks and companies. Then you had the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, or what you might say, the FATLAND. We've had the establishment of multiple Guantanamo Bays, They're in multiple countries. Then you have the Super Congress, right? The 12 Council of Governors, 13 with the President of the United States, which of course allows Congress to vote, but then if they vote no, the Super Congress can just override their vote. We have over 40 new governing czars. I don't recall having read anything about a czar anywhere in the Constitution.
Yeah, or having elected any czar or having any recourse against any czar.
Correct. We went to war in Syria without even getting a rubber stamp approval from Congress. And then just recently, and a lot of people have heard the buzz about this, Lord Obama, or should I say Barry Satoro.
I call him Emperor Obama.
Yeah, exactly. Dictator, emperor, wannabe. The 2012 National Defense Authorization Act. Now, almost every year you have a National Defense Authorization Act that's passed.
And this one was signed right near New Year's Eve, wasn't it, where nobody was really paying attention, as usual.
Correct. Much like the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913.
I believe that was done on
December 22nd.
Right. It was right before Christmas back in 1913. Yeah. Amazing.
Correct. So this draconian piece of legislation puts an end to posse comitatus. Posse comitatus is the separation of federal and local law enforcement. I mean, when you drive down the 405, if you're in LA or California, you don't see local military in full regalia working with your local police department. Well, now that they can fuse those two centers.
Yeah, and what that means, folks, there's a lot of meanings to it and a lot of levels to it. And Jay, I'm sure you're going to have some comments on this. But basically, one of the great things about the U.S. is the way it was constructed in the original intent of the Founding Fathers is that the military was only allowed for external use, not internal use. And now we have drone planes flying above American cities, military planes, and only a civilian police force was allowed to police U.S. citizens or people inside of the country, not the military. And that's very significant because when you look at these disgusting third world dictatorships around the country, these tyrannical regimes, the first thing they do is they gain control of the media and the military, probably the military first and then the media to do the propaganda later. And they get the military on their side and they oppress their own people with the power of the military rather than just a civilian police force.
Correct. And it also hits at the core of the separation of powers, separating the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. And that's exactly what's happening, is that the American people are slowly, methodically, systematically being oppressed by a government. And that's what the Founding Fathers also warned for and had tried to set up those checks and balances for which this bill erodes your rights and liberties to the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Particularly, it ends the Habeas Corpus Act, corpus being the body, habeas being to present or bring forth, which means back in the day where kings and dukes and duchesses would take a person and throw them in a black box in a dungeon, they're saying, no, you know, present the body, let's see why you're detaining or have imprisoned this person. That's gone. So now a military personnel or a police officer could indefinitely detain you, where you can face international rendition, which means to be taken out of the country to Morocco or somewhere else, subjected to extreme interrogation. Boy, isn't that a politically correct word for torture?
Right. And then probably a lot worse than waterboarding.
Yeah. And then executed by military tribunal as a citizen. So you have no right to face your accuser, no right to an attorney or legal representation, no right to a fair and speedy trial by judge or jury, no right to due process of law, which was formally granted in the Bill of Rights, and no right to petition the government for the redress of grievances. And some people would say, well, the bill actually says that these things don't really apply to American citizens. And I do have to admit, this bill was very craftily written. But if you continue on to the next section, particularly sections 1031 and 1032, virtually the next paragraph says, yeah, it doesn't apply to American citizens unless we, the government, think it does. So it's what the...
Gives them a lot of latitude, yeah.
Exactly. Well, the fine print taketh away. So you only hear the talking points that it doesn't apply and not the next paragraph, which removes that, you know, application.
Okay, so a couple things here, and I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because most people are familiar with the concerns and the problems. However, the first thing to take away, I think, from what you started to say is, look, Big Brother is watching you. It's becoming very, very Orwellian. But what I'd say with all of this stuff is that the U.S. is going in the wrong direction. There is no question about it. It is becoming more and more invasive and more tyrannical. But I would ask, compared to what? In other words, saying that the U.S. always had so many more rights for the individual than really any other country. I mean, the U.S. was the first real example of individual liberty and allowing the pursuit of happiness for the individual, not the collective. And my thinking is, even though it's going in the wrong direction, the U.S. still has a long way to fall before I want to look to other places. Or do you disagree with that?
Well, there was quite a bit said in there, so let me break it into two parts. I agree and I disagree. I do agree with the fact that the United States Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is by far the best instrument ever created to give an individual rights, unalienable rights, which are not given to that person by any type of governing body. And when those rights, those abilities to be able to live freely and independently, so long as you're not hurting another person, are removed. Because I love my country so much, I have the right to scrutinize her daily. And I'm not so concerned with what other people do, what other countries' activities are. I'm concerned with my own backyard, my own nation of birth, if you will. And unfortunately, the United States is, in my opinion, and many others, at the precipice of financial collapse. That's the largest threat to the United States right now. It's not so much of a military invasion or a rogue nuclear weapon, which, although, you know, could create massive destruction, that's not the primary threat to the United States. It's our currency. It's the devaluation of the United States dollar and our debt. The derivatives debt is somewhere between 1,100 trillion and 1,500 trillion, $1.5 quadrillion just in derivatives debt. So that's the real risk to the United States national security. And when you look at new bills, lastly, and we'll move on to the citizenship, but when you look at bills that are in progress right now, like House Resolution 1366 and Senate Bill 1698, this is called the Enemy Expatriation Act, EEA, sponsored by Senate traitor Joe Lieberman and corrupt Congressman Charles Dent. This bill would give the government to strip any American of their citizenship without being convicted of hostilities against the United States in this global war on terror that's supposed to last 100 years. So if you see the writing on the wall and you just say, hey, look, you know, I don't know, maybe people are waking up, but not enough, not quickly enough, we're too far down the line, and you just want to get out of Dodge, basically, and do your best to live in peace, we have options available for you to do that. And they might not be the options some people want to take, and they might not be necessarily the best options for you, but they could fit to a lot of people if they're interested in wanting to live in, you know, in the Caribbean and, you know, do your best, like I say, to live a peaceful life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So what can people do? What are the options, and how does one decide on the best place to go if they want to expatriate, or if they want to just have a plan B, if you will? Maybe they want to stay put for now, but they want to be able to go somewhere else if they need to or want to someday.
Correct. One of the first things I would really recommend that you do is to look around for countries in a climate that you like, that has reasonable infrastructure, it's safe, where English is spoken either as a primary or a secondary language, where they would enable you to obtain some type of a permanent residency and, if possible, the work visa or the work permit. That's the difficult part. Of course, if citizenship is an option, that would be ideal. And above all, where it's affordable and realistic for you. Sometimes the fantasy or the idea of moving offshore is very different than the ultimate reality of, you know, being in that community for an extended period of time. You also want to look for government programs that are available in writing that are open for public scrutiny and public review. I'll give you an example as one caution. There's a lot of advertisements out there for obtaining passports in countries like Guatemala. And Guatemala is a great country from a lot of perspectives, but the means in which you obtain a passport there is what you might call the greasy palms syndrome, you know, where for $50,000 or more, you grease enough palms along the way, and you can pretty much buy your way into a legitimate passport if you don't get ripped off along the way. And Guatemala just had a change in their administration. And so if the new administration comes in and they say, well, wait a minute, who authorized all of these passports in the past administration? We're going to revoke them unless you grease our palms, you know, or some other just Orwellian type of situation you don't want to find yourself in. So look for documentation, something that's in the Constitution or legislation that you can specifically point to that says they allow for a naturalization process. or investor citizenship program. There are primarily four countries which offer citizenship programs. I'll kind of start from the most expensive and work our way down. The most expensive really is Austria. They don't have any set figure, but it's understood to be around 3 to 4 million. So that just wipes most of reality off the charts.
You know what's funny about this is that when you look around the world, most countries, if you want to come in and gain citizenship there, you have to actually contribute something. You have to bring some money over or something like that. Whereas in the U.S., it's just, hey, you know, come in illegally and get all kinds of free stuff.
Correct. We have all the entitlements. We'll give to you if you come over and, yeah. Another subject, right? The next one on the list would be the Federation of St. Christopher and Nevis, also known as St. Kitts and Nevis. I'm actually in process right now to go under contract with a law firm in Nevis. It's not confirmed, but we're working on it. We're under negotiations. Nevis has a tremendous amount of infrastructure, very good from an investment standpoint for real estate for the most part. Their investor program requires a minimum of a $350,000 purchase of real property, which can't be moved or sold for a minimum of 5 years. And then if you're a married couple, you know, you're going to have another $40,000 in government fees and almost as much in attorney's fees to process that. But you don't even actually have to go there. Their background checks are so strong, they'll literally mail you the passport, you know, if you didn't even want to fly down there and, you know, once you've made your purchase. But again, unless you have close to $500,000 liquid, that makes it very difficult to want to move into that jurisdiction. Very similar to the Bahamas, if you wanted to live in Nassau, you know, again, you need to have a $500,000 minimum investment. Another one that a lot of people look to is the Commonwealth of Dominica, which is a different country. That's not to be confused with the Dominican Republic. The Commonwealth of Dominica is a different nation. It's kind of in the tail end, if you will, of the Caribbean. And their citizenship program has a minimum investment of $100,000 US. I think it's $105,000, right around $100,000, and approximately $130,000 for a small family. So the challenge is there, and I'm not throwing Dominica under the bus, but it's a much smaller country. The infrastructure is kind of, you know, middle of the bar, if you will, and you've really got to have your own means to support yourself financially should you decide to move there and purchase property in that country. You've really got to have something established where you have, you know, income coming in at that point. Make sense? So it generally speaking requires, you know, at least $100,000 of liquid cash funds to be able to move offshore to obtain citizenship if you weren't going to, you know, establish your own business or something of that nature, at which point pretty quickly you're going to be, you know, approaching that amount anyway. The country that we represent through one of the oldest, most well-respected law firms on the ground in is the Dominican Republic, where we offer citizenship services there. It's $9,500 US total. Actually, it's $8,130, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, and then there's a 16% Dominican Republic service tax. And so that's the other $1,310 approximately. So it's $9,500 per person. And the Dominican Republic has in their constitution, which was just amended and passed in 2010, the country's been founded since 1844, but as you know, constitutions aren't amended very often. So this is going to be a very stable program for many, many years. It was in existence prior to them. They made some little tweaks, but it's still in good standing. And Article 18, Section E of the Constitution establishes that a citizen is a person who is naturalized as a Dominican national. So it permits for dual citizenship, and the actual constitution, it's in Spanish, but it's on our website. And so you can see the document that allows for the authenticity of the citizenship program, and that's really very important. Section Article 19 doesn't require you to take up arms, you know, against your country of origin. Article 20 permits for dual nationalities. Article 22 entitles citizens the right to vote and run for public office, although not president or vice president. And Article 25, this is very important, it grants foreign nationals the same rights and duties as a natural-born Dominican citizen. So the program that we offer, it's really designed for people who want to live in the Dominican Republic, because that only requires two trips, an initial trip down and then the second trip when you actually move. If you just want the passport, the total process to citizenship and passport takes 4 years by law, but you'd have to make a total of 8 trips to to the Dominican Republic and back. So in all fairness, it's really, you know, unless you want to have an excuse, right, to go down to the Caribbean a couple times a year over the next several years, it's really designed for people who want to leave but don't know how or where to go. Make sense?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it does.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
Now's your opportunity to get the Financial Freedom Report. The Financial Freedom Report provides financial self-defense in uncertain times, and it's your source for innovative, forward-thinking investment property strategies and advice. Get your newsletter subscription today. You get a digital download and even more. The price, only $197. Go to jasonhartman.com to get yours today.
So I've been to the Dominican Republic, and it was actually, it's kind of a funny story because it's the only time I ever gave a seminar in a foreign language, and I was not speaking Spanish, but there were translators in the back of the room and people were wearing headsets, and it's kind of funny because everybody would, you know, you'd tell a joke and they'd laugh about a minute later. It was kind of an odd thing, a neat experience to have. But, you know, I got to tell you, Jay, I mean, just candidly, I mean, a lot of these countries, they're pretty primitive. When you get used to the U.S. and all the infrastructure here, I don't know if I could see myself living there. Maybe having a passport would be cool. What can I do with that passport if I don't live there? Kind of two questions there. Maybe answer them one and then the other.
Correct. I'll try to address your last one first because it's a little easier. The dual passports allow you to move around the world with a little bit more, I don't know if anonymity is the right word, but a little bit more privacy in the sense that, you know, having been to 32 countries around the world, you know, not everybody likes Americans, quite frankly, you know, and with 5, 6, 7 conflicts, wars, whatever you want to call them that we're involved in, you know, it lends reason to that. The Dominican Republic was a founding member of the United Nations, and so they have open trade relations with Mexico, the United States, Canada, all of the EU, and most, if not all, of Africa and Asia. So it's a very business-friendly country, and it gives you that ability in the event of civil unrest to leave the country under that passport. Insofar as living in another country is concerned, you know, yeah, when you're used to going down to your little local movie theater or picking up an iPhone at the store and doing your shopping, we're very obviously consumer-oriented country, whereas we used to be manufacturing and textiles, that could be difficult for some people. It really could. There's a little bit of a culture shock when you leave your country. But I'll tell you what, after 2 or 3 months, kind of when that initial you've jumped into the deep end of the pool, if you will, and you feel that rush of cold water, and you start to swim around a little bit, you realize that it's nice just not being inundated with this mass media advertising billboard, just constant bombardment of stuff where you can just go to one of the top 10 beaches in the world or throw on a backpack and go hiking and not have to contend with that side of media world, if you will, in the United States. That's probably been one of the biggest benefits for me, is just the quality of life is much more tranquil.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We're definitely bathed in media in the U.S. or the Western world in general. Okay. So tell us more.
Okay. So I'm just going to cover the all of these steps, by the way, are on our website. We list specifically all the services that we provide with, you know, the prices. There's no back-end fees. There's no hidden costs. There's no extraneous expenses you might be looking at incurring. Basically, you take a trip down to the Dominican Republic. In fact, I'm going to be there myself the first 2 weeks in February. If someone from your show happens to be in the area or is serious and wants to hop down and meet up with me down there and the law firm, please feel free to get in contact with us. We'd be happy to do that. You take a trip down to the Dominican Republic. You go to the capital, Santo Domingo, and it's a 2 half-day process. The first half day, we process your documentation. All this is on the website, the original birth certificate, marriage license. You do need a certificate of no criminal record, a couple passport photos, copy of your university degree if you should have one, and then your passport, which is returned to you because it shows your stamp of entrance into the country. Second day, for about 4 hours, about from 8 o'clock in the morning till noon, you go in for a government mandatory medical examination, just a quick urine and blood sample and a chest x-ray. You know, they want to make sure you don't have any, you know, contagious diseases, something like an HIV or cancer or something of that nature. They just want to make sure that you're physically, you know, in well-being. And then that's about it. The law firm and I, we take care of the rest of your paperwork, the notarization, your letter of guarantee, affidavit of solvency, complete your application forms to the immigrations department. And 6 months later, you have to wait 6 months, 5 to 6 months, you get an okay from the government. And provided that, you know, you're in good health, drug-free, things of that nature, we haven't had anybody rejected yet, unless you've got issues of that nature. Then you can move to the Dominican Republic, duty-free with all of your household goods. You can live and you can work there. Now, you don't get your citizenship right away. You don't get your passport right away. It actually comes another 3.5 years after that. The first year that you're there, you're given what's called a provisional residency card, which allows you to live there and work without having to leave the country every 90 days like you would on a tourist visa. After that year, you're given a 2-year permanent residency card. Again, you continue to live and work there. When you renew that 2-year residency card, then you can apply for your citizenship and your passports. Very simple process, very straightforward. We help you all the way through. And then you actually go to your swearing in of your oath to the Dominican Republic. You have a little Spanish test prior to that, citizenship test. And we pay all the fees to the Banco de Reservas, your passport taxes. You receive your naturalization certificate, your birth certificate, your Dominican Republic ID card for citizenship, and then, of course, your passport.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you, so first question is, it costs $9,500 to do this, right?
Correct, per person, yes, sir.
So is that what the government of the DR charges? Is that what you charge? Or it's probably a blend of the two. You're taking care of the details and the legal stuff, I guess, and then there's probably some government fees as well. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, there really aren't too much in government fees, to be honest with you. It's mostly a service charge. It really is. And quite frankly, we have to spend 4 years with you. There's another gentleman out there who lives in the Dominican Republic. I'm not going to say his name, but let's just say it's an advisory service. And he charges, and this was because I requested information from him for three adults. It was close to $70,000 for three adults, $68,000, $69,000. And I'm like, you know, that was the same question I had. Can you please explain and justify to me $22,000 just to file paperwork for the most part and to provide some customer support? And the only answer I was given was, well, because it's less than other countries, that's why he charges what he does. So, you know, there's the old adage, you get what you pay for, right? But at some point, in my opinion, it becomes usurious. You know, it just becomes excessive. $8,130 inclusive of all of the fees. We have people on the ground from the law firm who personally escort you. I want to make sure I have the complete list. We personally escort you to for your medical examination to the immigrations department for the filing of Ministry of Interior documents. Then we escort you for your escort, your oath, your Spanish interview, and you know all of the other government procedures that you have in there. You know, there are some small fees that are built into that from the government, but for the most part, it's a service to have someone hold your hand through 4 years of process to make sure that it's done, you know, properly.
Yeah.
So,
I'm not denouting. You don't have to spend a lot of time justifying that. You know, everybody needs to charge fees for things. No problem there. But my other question, Jay, is that say one goes through this process, they pay the $9,500, they get the citizenship, and that's all great. What do they do next? A lot of listeners are maybe wealthier clients, and they want to get money outside of the U.S. and a large part of it is not government that they're really in fear of. You know, they own businesses, they're in fear of litigation. You know, the climate is so litigious in the United States that they're just afraid that what they've worked for all their life will be attacked by some frivolous lawsuit, and they want to maybe put some chips on another table, so to speak.
Correct. And we have a lot of strategies available for that, both inside the United States, primarily through the use of Nevada corporations, limited liability companies, of course, living trusts for estate planning, land trusts for avoiding a number of taxes with a real property. And should a person want to incorporate in Belize or create an offshore foundation or an irrevocable trust to make use of the 2011-2012 lifetime gift tax laws, which is up to $5 million, which you can, you know, lawfully, irrevocably gift for generation succession planning for your children or your grandchildren, there are ways to be able to move your assets offshore in full view of the IRS and the government and do it properly, and making sure that you have, in my opinion, gold reserves, silver reserves, just kind of common sense things. I don't think we've even come close to seeing the end of the rise in the price of gold and silver.
I beg to differ with you there in one slight distinction, whether it's nominal dollars or real dollars, because you could have said that another way. I don't think we've even come close to seeing the devaluation of the dollar.
Right? Correct. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. It was saying the same thing from the other side of the coin, no pun intended. But yes, absolutely. We don't have a currency. We have monopoly money. It just happens to be printed on better paper.
Yeah, so, you know, but then I'd say, Jay, and I don't want to get off on a big tangent on this, since you brought that up, though, compared to who? Compared to what other country? Every country's got monopoly money. It's not just America that has fiat currency. It's every currency in the globe's a fiat currency, and they're all being debased. It's a race to the bottom.
Correct. The difference or the distinction I would make for the United States is that the United States is the only country in the world that has the ability to print the world's reserve currency and continue to print their way out of debt. A lot of other countries have a much more difficult time because they don't have that ability. Now, they may bury themselves by going further into debt with the World Bank or with the IMF, but they don't have the ability to just arbitrarily print money to pay for their loans or fund their wars, as does the United States. And I believe that when the United States loses its status as the world's reserve currency, which we're headed toward, you know, when, it's obviously hard to say, that's going to create some very, very serious repercussions in the entire financial community.
Okay, go ahead. So in terms of moving assets and money offshore, you got to do it in full view of the IRS or you are going to be a sorry, sorry person. So this is
correct,
all,
absolutely.
This is a discussion of doing it right and doing it legally. What tips do you have?
Well, we work with several different tax advisors and tax consultants. We have tax experts who are both international tax attorneys. You know, they're not cheap, but they're obviously very good. We also have people who have worked for KPMG for decades, so they're very familiar with international tax strategies and tax consequences. And we make sure that we get you in touch directly with those people to meet your specific tax needs, because that's just a whole nother category. But as a citizen of another country, you certainly have the right and the means to be able to move your assets offshore into that jurisdiction as you see fit as a citizen. And just living in the Dominican Republic, it's pretty beautiful, man. It's got one of the top 10 beaches in the world, the highest mountain in the Caribbean at over 3,000 meters, a little over 10,000 feet. So you've got some elevation to play with. Average temperatures year-round are about 25 degrees Celsius, 77 degrees Fahrenheit. Annual precipitation is under 60 inches a year, 150 centimeters. Of course, the Spanish originally settled the country years ago. And so there's that influence, beautiful homes, villas, PGA quality golf courses, open import and export laws, as I shared with you, to some of the largest communities in the world. And it's a Caribbean lifestyle, which is actually affordable and realistic. So within an hour and a half flight, you can hop back to Miami or to Houston, Texas. And being that you're right dead smack in the center of the Caribbean, if you happen to have a yacht or a small boat or a catamaran, what have you, you can cruise around to all the other islands, which a lot of people there do. There's some pretty nice boating communities there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Good stuff. Well, what else would you like people to know about these types of opportunities? And if you want to mention some other countries that are kind of on your radar as well, feel free to do that.
Insofar as citizenship is concerned, the only three that we're focusing on, one which we're fully operational for, is the Dominican Republic. We're looking at bringing Nevis online and possibly the Commonwealth of Dominica. And in that regard, you'd kind of have your small, medium, and high-priced countries in which to obtain citizenship offshore. Insofar as just residing in another country, man, you can, you know, the world's your oyster. Have at it. You could go to Ecuador or, you know, really anywhere you wanted to in Central South America, Brazil, Venezuela, whatever country happens to meet and suit your needs and your fancy. It's just the ability to work and create an income that can really create a challenge for you.
Good. Good to know. Jay, give out your website once again, if you would, and tell people where they can learn more.
Sure. It's assetprotectionservices.com. And all of our contact information is there. If you click on the page for Dominican Republic, it'll open up a beautiful page with photos and information on the culture and the history and the climate, activities, just a tremendous resource of information about the country generally. And then there's a page, of course, for the citizenship, where virtually all of the information we've covered with you today, shy of the political aspect, is covered on that page as well, with pricing and very articulate, detailed list of the services that are provided for those costs.
frequently asked questions, things of that nature.
Fantastic. Well, Jay Butler, thanks so much for joining us today. I would like to openly and publicly extend the invitation right here on the show for you to join us again and talk about some of these other issues, which being a global citizen, a citizen of the world, you're very familiar with. And I think we'd have some interesting discussions about the Bilderberg Group and about monetary and fiscal policy around the world and just some other things as well. So love to have you back on to talk about that. So please join us again.
Well, thank you very much. It's very flattering, and I would graciously accept. Thank you so much.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.